And is Morden versus XL Specialty Insurance. Ready to hear from the appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Eric Olson, I represent the appellants, the Mordens. The district court made three legal errors in dismissing the Mordens' bad faith claims, third-party claims. First, it applied the first-party, fairly debatable standard to these third-party claims. Second, it applied the fairly debatable standard incorrectly. And third, the court refused to recognize XL's fiduciary duties that arise in this context. I'll address each of those in turn, and then I'd like to address the cross-appeal of the interrelated wrongful acts issue. Starting with the correct standard, an insurer's duty in handling a third-party claim is construed as based on an objective reasonableness standard in Utah. Under Black, claims submitted by third parties must be diligently investigated to determine their validity and then reasonably evaluated in light of all the facts. And then specifically in the settlement context, under Campbell, when faced with a third-party settlement offer, the insurer owes its insured a duty to accept an offer of settlement within the policy limits if there is a substantial likelihood of an excess verdict. We presented facts on summary judgment to show that XL's conduct did not satisfy this standard. We included an expert opinion from an insurance expert going to this issue. That created disputes of fact that precluded summary judgment. But first,
wait, in terms of
yes, Your Honor.
The expert said what did the defendant do wrong, according to the expert?
The expert detailed a number of things. We've detailed those on pages 18 and 19 of our brief.
These had to do with investigating?
Yes.
Can you characterize them? Because let's start with investigation. What should have they investigated, and what would they have found that would have changed their opinion?
Our expert has opined that they should have gone out and gotten a coverage opinion where they would have had an independent attorney go through and review this more carefully. They could have corresponded directly to try to understand exactly what the losses were that the Mordens had suffered, which were well in excess of the policy limits. The insurance company could have done any number of things to understand better and get itself to a point of understanding.
Were there any facts regarding coverage that they should have investigated, and what would they have found? Is it just that they didn't get a legal opinion, and second, that they didn't appreciate how large the losses would be, so they might want to compromise in some way? Mm-hmm. Or is there some investigation of facts regarding coverage that was not investigated? That was not done.
Yes, as our opinion detailed, it was certainly there was more that could have been done to understand the interrelatedness or lack of interrelatedness of the two claims.
I'm not fighting with you. I'm trying to understand.
Right.
So try to come forward with the sort of things that they could have looked into that would have supported coverage that they failed to do, because I'm not clear on that.
Well, certainly they could have gone through the SEC correspondence, the notices themselves, to see that the Mordens' claim did not arise from those notices. That's something that could have been determined. And then certainly they could have determined that
notices mentioned the mine?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
None of the material from the SEC mentioned the mine? I thought it did.
It absolutely did not. It did not mention the mine, the three SEC notices, and that goes...
Was there anything else in the SEC investigation that they would have found that referred to the mine? To the mine?
Well, the issue is not what the SEC proceedings included. The issue under the law is what the notices were. The notices that were presented to the insured and what the insured reasonably should have viewed from the notices.
Did the cease and desist cover the mine?
It did. The cease and desist.
The final ruling by the SEC, did it include the mine?
Yes, the ultimate final decision, finally, at that point in time, the issue of the mine does come up
right.
in that final decision. The problem is, and if I can just focus for a moment on the interrelated wrongful acts issue and answer to Your Honor's question, the problem there is that the first step in identifying whether this interrelated wrongful acts provision is invoked is to define what the claim is. The claim at issue is the SEC claim, and nowhere in Xcel's brief does it appeal from the definition that the court reached of that claim, which is the three notices that were presented by the SEC during the policy period. Xcel has argued now in this appeal that somehow the entire SEC proceeding constitutes a claim, but that's at odds with the policy, because the policy refers to a specific written notice.
Maybe I misunderstand you. Isn't there argument that it doesn't have to be that specific claim, it has to be related to it? Isn't that the issue?
No, that's part two. The first step is to define the claim.
Okay.
The claim is the written notice, and Judge Waddups did that. There's been no challenge to his definition of the claim as the three notices. And then the next step, while the interrelated wrongful acts provision is itself broad, uses words like any, related, what the court then proceeded to do correctly is using the relate back paragraph. That paragraph instead says arising from. So even if there is some interrelatedness, when you have two claims, the Morden's claim on the one hand and the SEC's claim on the other hand, the Morden's claim has to arise from the interrelated wrongful acts. And there is nothing in the claim, that is those three notices, from which the Morden's claim about the mind arises. That's what Judge Waddups concluded, and that was the correct decision. So going then to bad faith claims, first, the fairly debatable standard does not apply in third-party claims, and we see that from the very definition of fairly debatable. The district court quoted three cases citing the fairly debatable standard, and each one of them says that the court allows debate of, quote, the insured's claim, close quote. Only in first-party insurance is there an evaluation of the insured's claim. Here, we're dealing with a third-party E&O policy, where what is being evaluated is the third-party Morden's claim against the insured, not the insured's claim against the insurance company. Hence, fairly debatable does not apply. And there's not been a single case cited by the district court or cited on appeal that would suggest that fairly debatable does apply in the third-party context, which is what we have here.
And you're arguing that this claim, your claim, falls within tort and not contract.
Well, it falls in both, Your Honor, yes. Certainly there's the contractual good faith and fair dealing claim that exists in any bad faith case. And secondly, in the third-party context, yes, there's the breach of fiduciary duty claim that applies.
But are you contending there was a duty to defend here, and that's what's giving rise to your claims?
Not necessarily. Our expert had some opinions about how this is akin to a duty to defend, but a duty to defend is not necessary to trigger these third-party heightened duties. The district court suggested that that's what Black says, but it's not. Black does not limit fiduciary duties only where there is a duty to defend. Utah courts have widely stated that in the third-party context, you have a heightened duty. You have these fiduciary duties. That's what the court stated in Beck. And in Campbell, in both of those cases, the court explained that the law imposes in the third-party context a fiduciary duty on the insurer because of the trust and reliance.
That was fiduciary duty to do what? To handle the settlement?
There were a number of duties mentioned in those cases.
Here the argument, the other side, is that because they disclaimed coverage, so they didn't actually exert any control over the settlement or the litigation, they had no fiduciary duty with respect to that. They wiped their hands of it. They didn't assume a responsibility to take care of the settlement or litigation. Are those cases, what of the cases you have involve similar types of duties as alleged or violated here?
Okay, first off, they did get involved. XL corresponded directly with the Mordens to tell them that they were denying their settlement offer. If they just washed their hands of it, why would they send a settlement response letter directly to the Mordens counsel? Shouldn't they have just corresponded directly with their insured? That's a problem. That certainly is evidence of agency here, which is one of the circumstances where this fiduciary duty arises. But more broadly than that, the insurance company is still relied on. They're still in a position of trust. If they choose to do nothing, that doesn't change the fact that the insured here counted on them to investigate, counted on them to reasonably evaluate the Morden's third-party claim, and counted them on acting fairly and reasonably in evaluating and settling the Morden's claim. Those are all duties.
All of that arises out of their, as I understood the policies, the duty to indemnify. That was their duty, was the duty to indemnify.
Not in the case law. The case law specifies that those are all duties triggering third-party fiduciary duties.
A duty to indemnify triggers a fiduciary duty?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what we have specifically under Black, Beck, and Campbell, we have reference to these specific duties that I just mentioned, including the fiduciary duty to act fairly and reasonably in evaluating and settling the third-party claim. We're back to Judge Hart's question. The insurance company simply said, we're not going to get involved. We're just denying coverage. That doesn't change the fact that they have a duty arising under Utah law to act fairly and reasonably in evaluating and settling the third-party claim. They still have that duty. Justice Durham, the Utah Supreme Court, we provided this opinion to the court just recently, issued an extensive concurring opinion going through all the history of Utah bad faith law. I understand it's dicta. I understand it was not controlling in that case. But it is one of the most extensive recitations of Utah insurance law I've ever seen, and it's entirely consistent with that, detailing how these are third-party, in third-party cases, you have these fiduciary duties. Now, even if the fairly debatable standard could be applied, it was applied here incorrectly. And that's based on the Jones case, which requires summary judgment not to be entered if reasonable minds could differ as to whether the insurer's conduct measures up to the standard required for insurance claim investigations. We had the clash of the experts, just as in this court's Wheeler case recently, just as in the district court's Barandi case, both citing Jones. Under these circumstances, the court applied the wrong standard, applied the standard incorrectly, and based on the fact dispute, summary judgment was precluded. I'll reserve my remaining minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is David Gish, and I represent XL Specialty Insurance Company. With me is Gabriella Rickheimer, who also represents XL Specialty. We are the appellee in the appeal and the cross-appellant in the cross-appeal. This case was extensively litigated before Judge Wadhams. There were numerous cross-motions for summary judgment. There were extremely lengthy oral arguments. There were three lengthy opinions. he correctly analyzed all of the issues relating to the bad faith claims, and we request that this panel affirm those dismissals of the two bad faith claims that were asserted by the Mordens. The one exception to his careful analysis was on the analysis of the coverage issue of interrelated claims. We disagree with that. We believe that although he did talk about the Bresic versus Young opinion, he did not give it the proper weight, and he made certain mistakes. I'll get into that toward the end of my presentation.
Let me ask a quick question about the cross appeal. I wasn't trying to cross appeal. If you prevail on all the issues on appeal, is the cross appeal moot?
It's not. It's the court. The court does not have to reach the cross appeal unless it believes that Judge Wadoffs was incorrect and the Tenth Circuit wants to create. But you don't have to reach it. If you affirm the bad faith.
If you win on the main arguments appellants you win. That's it.
That's it. Case is over.
The cross appeal was an alternative way for you to prevail.
Yes.
Okay, that's not a cross appeal. You shouldn't have cross appealed for that. Cross appeal is if you want more than what you got in district court.
Except, Your Honor, we looked at that very carefully, and if it were just an additional argument for us to appeal, I believe that that would be correct. But the difference here is that the actual judgment that the district court entered not only entered a judgment in favor of XL on the bad faith claims, but specifically entered a judgment in favor of the Mordens on the cross appeal. So we had that judgment pending against us, and so we, under Tenth Circuit law, we were entitled to file the cross appeal. Okay. We looked at that carefully. So with regard to the bad faith claims, let me start by saying let's make sure we understand the fairly debatable doctrine. The district court correctly held that the claim was barred by the fairly debatable doctrine under Utah law. It is well established under Utah law that if the insurer acts reasonably, and that's one answer to a lot of what the Morden's counsel was arguing. There's already inherently a reasonableness argument in the fairly debatable. In its evaluation of the case, it is not liable for breach of the implied covenant for denying coverage, even if ultimately the insurer is wrong in its coverage denial. Now, the Mordens argue that the fairly debatable standard does not apply in third-party claims. And I will suggest to you that you need to be very careful when you look at all of the Utah case law on first-party versus third-party. Because whenever the Utah cases refer to third-party claims, they always refer to duty to defend claims. And so that is embedded in the notion, when you talk about the shorthand of first-party versus third-party, it's embedded in that notion that third-party claims are duty to defend policies. I would urge the court to look at the district court's opinion, footnotes 15 and 20, because in both of those footnotes, the court very carefully spells out that, as the court already recognizes, this is not a duty to defend policy. It is a duty to pay or a duty to reimburse. Now, what does that mean? That's not just some technical distinction. A duty to defend policy requires that the insurer appoint its own counsel to represent the insured. And it takes over the entire litigation, the strategy for the litigation, what motions are filed, what depositions are taken, and it most importantly, the reason for the heightened concern under the duty to defend is the insurer that has the right to settle. Sometimes with the insured's consent, sometimes not. But the insurer has the right to settle. That's not the case with XL's policy.
So with the policy in paragraph 2B, I guess, where it says it shall be the duty of insureds to defend any claim under this policy, do we rely on any of the Utah third-party cases? Do we rely on any of the Utah first-party, or are we just in our own category here on the drift?
It is a bit of a hybrid, But I think that the district court got exactly right in those two footnotes that I referenced in saying that even though this is a third party policy in which it covers for claims by third parties against the insured, it's not a third party duty to defend, and therefore it's more akin. It's not a first party policy, but it's more akin in the critical question of whether it's a contract liability or a tort liability. And if it's and he says it's contract liability, it's a duty to indemnify. So it's a contract liability, and therefore there's no doubt that in a contract setting, which is called first party, which again, I understand this isn't first party, but the court concluded, I don't have to reach whether fairly debatable is applicable in third party claims because this is not a duty to defend policy, and therefore it's akin, it's a contract claim, and fairly debatable applies. So
counsel referred to a long concurrence by Justice Durham. Does that address this issue at all?
Yes, that addresses this issue, but let me make several things clear.
Do you disagree with what she said in some?
It's not what I think. several things. It's clear, number one, that the majority, the four justices who did the majority opinion, make very clear she is not stating what Utah law currently is. And they kind of make a little fun of her about maybe, you know, this was brilliant, maybe it's great. You can look at the citation on that.
She is brilliant. That's why I'm interested in what she has to say.
Well, she is very passionate about this, but the majority makes clear that it is not current Utah law. But the other important thing, when you read her concurrence, because she constantly refers to duty to defend. So you go back to the same issue. In some ways, it's irrelevant. It's what Judge Wadups did, which was exactly right. It's not third party because it's not duty to defend. So all of what she's saying, and again, the Beck case and all of the cases that the Morton's Council cite, when you're concerned about what an insurance company is doing with regard to settlement, it's because they're controlling it. We didn't control it here. And on the point of did we control it, I would urge you to look at, remember, the Mortons gave notice of the SEC proceeding as well, the SEC complaint, and they gave notice of that. And in the context of assessing the coverage of that, we learned that Mr. Pugsley was the defense counsel for for Belson, Getty, and Drew, and represented them throughout. All we did was ask, what were your rates and how are you staffing it? And when those were fine, we said, fine, he can continue to do that. And he negotiated the entire settlement with the SEC. XL did not have anything to do with the resolution of the SEC proceeding. And that's exactly the way these policies work.
What was this letter saying, we reject the settlement?
That related to the 2 years after we had denied, XL had denied coverage, and we got a demand for $1 million. Dollar limit settlement. That demand came, as I recall, came from the Morton's counsel. And I believe we coordinated with defense counsel and they agreed that we should send our letter explaining the basis for our denial of coverage to the Mortons so they would be aware of it. We weren't interjecting ourselves into the settlement. The import of that letter was there's no coverage, so it's not our issue. If Belson Getty wanted to accept a $1 million settlement and then turn around and sue XL to pay on a duty to indemnify, that was clearly within their right to do that. But they didn't. So,
yeah, that's fine.
And so it's XL's view that both with regard to the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the contract claim, and with regard to breach of fiduciary duty, once you don't have a duty to defend, there's clearly no fiduciary duty. You're back in the contract realm, and fairly debatable applies. With regard to the Black case, I think that it's abundantly clear in the Black case that that case holds that in a situation where pre-litigation, the insurance company under a duty to defend policy did not undertake any defense, and it was the insured that was negotiating whatever settlement that apparently didn't work out, there was no fiduciary duty because the insurer, even though they had a duty to defend, did not undertake that defense, therefore no breach of fiduciary duty. One final point, one case, if you do, we don't urge you to do it, but if you do feel the need to, especially given this recent case, the Fire Insurance versus Oatman's case, if you do feel the need to address the issue of whether third-party claims, the fairly debatable doctrine applies, we would urge you to look at the case of U.S. Fidelity versus U.S. Sports Specialty. It's a 2012 Utah Supreme Court decision.
Is that in your briefing?
It is.
Okay.
It is. But basically, there, it's not directly a failure to settle, but the insurer paid an excess judgment, tried to get the funds back from the insured. The Utah Supreme Court said unless the policy allows you to do that, you don't get it back. The insurer screamed, well, that means we have no choice. We have to defend everything no matter what the coverage issues are. And the Utah Supreme Court said, no. If you have a debatable position, not every time that you deny coverage, if you're wrong, if it's reasonable, you're not liable. And most significantly, to support that, it drops a footnote and cites two cases, first-party cases, but it squarely says fairly debatable. So, and interestingly, in that recent case from November, the U.S. sports case, the majority is worried that this wasn't adversarial, it wasn't correctly briefed, it wasn't briefed at all, this issue wasn't briefed at all. They never mention, neither side mentions the U.S. sports case. So obviously, you know, our view is if we ever, you know, when it comes up, you know, in the Supreme Court, that's a case that the Supreme Court of Utah will look at. But they've indicated that fairly debatable applies in the third party realm. Let me just go to the cross appeal. I only have 2 minutes left, but I do want to point out the Bresic case. It is very difficult to reconcile the result, even though the judge references it, the reconcile the result in this case with the Bresic case. You are supposed to, under Bresic, look at the commonalities, not focus on the differences. And here we think that the court clearly focused on the differences. Also, what the court overlooked is if you compare the allegations of the SEC complaint with the Morden complaint, the Morden complaint was essentially lifted from the SEC complaint, and the Morden complaint makes it even clearer because there are in paragraphs 88 and 89 of the Morden's complaint, they tie together as a related common scheme that what Belson Getty and Drew was doing was that they were giving illiquid, improper, too risky investments to Belson Getty clients, and they were failing to disclose specific conflicts of interest involving Drew or his family members or other people. In the Morden complaint, they specifically tied those paragraphs together to all four of the investments at issue, including the Mexican mine. So we think the judge just missed the point that if you look at the allegations of the complaints, in the Morden complaint, they allege the relatedness. We weren't making it up. We were just saying what the Mordens themselves alleged. And they lifted that from, in fact, in the SEC complaint, the SEC complaint talks a good deal about the Mexican mine, but when they have those two paragraphs that I just described, they don't include the Mexican mine. But when the Mordens lifted that paragraph, they stuck the Mexican mine into that. What could be better evidence that they believe the Mexican mine was of the same piece, the same common scheme or common plan, and was there a sufficient factual nexus? Those are all the tests that were adopted in Bresic. The language was the same. We think that the coverage opinion ought to be overturned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The good news is that this court is not adrift on bad faith issues. The majority in the Altman's case did not disagree with Justice Durham, but said it was unnecessary and dicta. Justice Durham showed how the duty to defend is just one of four different fiduciary duties. There is no authority that if the duty to defend is gone, the fiduciary duties just disappear, the remaining fiduciary duties. Not a single case has been cited in this case suggesting anything to that effect, that somehow we're in no man's land and out of fiduciary duty land if there's not a duty to defend.
So you just have some kind of generic fiduciary duty?
It's not generic. Those
put a label
duties are,
on it. It's not a duty to defend, so what kind of a fiduciary duty is it?
It's detailed in those cases. Includes, for example, the duty to investigate the Morden's claim, to reasonably evaluate it in light of all the facts, and to act fairly and reasonably in evaluating and settling the Morden's claim.
Do you have any cases where there is expressly not a duty to defend, where those additional fiduciary duties are imposed?
Unfortunately, no, because it is so typical that there is a duty to defend in these cases. However, when you read how Justice Durham has walked through it, and it's the same as it's laid out in the Campbell case, in the Black case, in the Beck case, those are all laid out as separate fiduciary duties, not all arising from the duty to defend. They're separate duties, and based on the fact issues raised by the experts, their fact disputes precluding summary judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted.